He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hello, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
Since we left you all yesterday at 3 o'clock, we were here for an extra hour, we learned much more about the weapons which caused such destruction on Monday. We learned the third person killed was a grad student at BU from China. And just as we learned, there was a vigil held for an 8-year-old Bruins fan from Dorchester. But Marjorie, the ultimate proof that the world has changed, even if it's only briefly, Sweet Caroline was played at Yankee Stadium yesterday.
I know, and they put up their logo, the Yankees did, side by side with the Red Sox B and the message, United We Stand, which is pretty incredible. We also learned that President Barack Obama will visit the Holy Cross Cathedral in the South End tomorrow for a prayer service at 11 o'clock. That United Airlines brought back to the gate a plane after passengers expressed fear about two passengers speaking a different language. And you mentioned that Bruins fan from Dorchester. I think we know now that the image that's going to capture this whole tragedy will be the picture of little Martin Richards, 8 years old, from Dorchester, holding up a sign he made in his classroom, which reads, "No more hurting people, peace."
I know. Something else has been added to the mix since yesterday as well. This morning, a Bostonian had a great piece in the New York Times. It was entitled "Messing with the Wrong City." His latest book is "Live by Night." Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Dennis Lehane.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, great, Dennis. Thank you for joining us. You wrote a terrific piece this morning, which I read when I got up, in the New York Times, called "Messing with the Wrong City." What'd you say, Dennis?
I think expressed a sentiment that also Thomas Friedman expressed in an accompanying column that, you know, we're not going to be changed by this. We're not going to be cowed. We're not going to give up our civil liberties. We're not going to go stockpile weapons. We're Bostonians. We're going to pick ourselves up. We're going to move on.
You started with a great image of you and your parents many years ago driving through South Boston. Tell our listeners about that.
We got stuck in a on West Broadway in what was a pretty scary rally against busing. What was going on was they were burning effigies of Garrity, of Kevin White, of Teddy Kennedy. And as a 9-year-old, to kind of look through, I have a very vivid memory of the reflection of the flames washing over the windows of the car. And we couldn't move. I mean, we were just very slowly moving down West Broadway. And I remember looking out and seeing these faces that were just sort of rabid with rage. And it just stuck with me, and it was something that I wanted to put in because, A, it was my first experience with rage, and then, B, it was to say to the readers outside of Boston, look, I'm a homer. I love my city more than I can ever explain, but I love it warts and all.
You know, Dennis, you write that story that Marjorie just asked you to tell. You're writing about yourself as not such a young kid, but you also tell a wonderful story about talking to a very young kid, namely your 4-year-old daughter, and trying to explain this mess from Monday. What was that like?
It was terrible.
What'd you tell her?
I told her that, you know, some very bad men were out there, did a very bad thing, but that we weren't in danger. But as I said that, and it was something I touched on very lightly in the column, as I said that, I wasn't sure it was true, you know, that we wouldn't be touched, that we would be you know, suddenly you're telling your kid, you know, you're safe, and you're thinking in your head, is she?
Love the line where you say, my daughter asked if the bad men were like the bad woman who hit her on the head with a suitcase last time we were on a plane.
That was terrible.
And then didn't apologize.
Right. Right. That actually did happen. That actually happened. A woman hit her on the head with a suitcase, and the woman had literally said, when she first got on the plane, saw my kids and said, I want to shoot myself.
Oh, great.
I mean, she was just a vile human being. And then she was pulling her suitcase out, and of course it hit my daughter in the head, and she just started wailing and crying, and the woman just said, oh, I'm sure you're going to blame me for that. I was like, who else would I blame? You know?
What did her father do to defend her honor, Dennis Lehane?
Her father spoke very seriously, I would say, to the woman. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah, things are getting very vicious in the overhead baggage bins. That's all I could say, Dennis Lehane. It's out of control when you start picking on 4-year-old kids. But, you know, But getting back to this piece, I mean, I like to think that we're different here, and that we won't be cowering next year in the marathon. I'm not as much. I am a chicken. I think I'm going to be looking over my shoulder at next year's marathon. I'm not going to go to the finish line. I never have, in truth, gone to the finish line. I've watched it all in Beacon Street in Brookline. But I'm going to be looking over my shoulder. It's not going to be the same for me.
No, I don't think it's ever the same for anybody. But, you know, I think at the same time, okay, so we'll look over our shoulder a little bit more. I don't think anybody's going to go to a sporting event in the next several months in this city without feeling it. You know what
yeah.
I mean? I think that any time that a crowd is gathered, we're going to start feeling it. But then you say, well, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to do exactly what the Israelis do. We're going to pick up and we're going to move on, you know, and we're just going to continue what Europe's been doing for years, what the, you know, what Londoners did. I mean, we're not going to change who we are for this. That was, I thought, the most scary thing about 2001, you know, 9/11, was that they wanted us to change, and for a little while we did. And I say, you know, and I think Thomas Friedman said the same thing in the New York Times, said, no, we're not changing. No, we're not going to become you. Hey. Whoever you are, whatever you end up being, whether you're a homegrown lunatic or whether you're Islamic jihadist, whatever you are, we will not change just because you poured your pollution at us.
Dennis, let's go back to Monday at 2:50. When did you first hear about this? And as a lifer, as a homer, what was your reaction to this when it was right in your midst? What, do you live a couple of miles away from the finish line, right?
Yeah, yeah, and used to live, you know, pretty much two blocks away from the finish line. So, yeah, I took it quite emotionally. I took it quite personally, and I found out it happened at 2:50. I think I found out by about 3:10, and then I went and I took a walk into the Brookline post office, right down this, you know, and the marathoners were still sort of straggling through, but word had gotten out by that point. I don't know. I'm still processing my emotions, to be honest.
You had some interesting encounters in that walk. Could you share those with us, if you would?
Yeah, I ran into a homeless woman who said, you know, did they get the demons who did this? And I said, I don't know. And she said, just emphatically, she said, they will. And then I found a woman just sitting on a lawn. She was dressed for the marathon. She'd clearly been in the marathon. She was just sitting there, and she was just weeping uncontrollably. And I asked her if I could do anything for her, if I could help her, if anything, and she just shook her head. You know, there was nothing to do. There was nothing to say, you know. Yes, I wrote a piece for the New York Times, and I believe everything that I said in it, and I stand by it, but I'm still processing as well.
Yeah. We're talking with Dennis Lehane, who is a great novelist. Live by Night is his greatest book, is his latest book, I should say. Maybe you'd say it's your greatest book, too. I don't know, Dennis, but author of Mystic River. You all know him. He's a terrific writer. You know, I'm going to be crass, Dennis, but I can't resist asking you, because you are a writer and you are a novelist. Does part of this whole scenario become some future plot for you? It's just a couple of days later, and I know that's crass, but you're a writer. I wonder about that.
No, I think that some of the themes that I've always written about are encapsulated in this event. Certainly, I'm fascinated with violence. I'm fascinated with rage. You know, so certainly I could see it coming in on some base level. But no, I would never write about this event. I think that's for a different type of writer than me. It's real. It's for Don DeLillo.
Hey,
he's also a great writer. He's also a great writer.
Hey, Dennis Lehane, before we let you go, last time we spoke to you, there was something else you were dealing with on a much smaller scale.
Oh, on a much smaller scale.
I know, but I mean, it is what it is. It mattered to you personally. A missing dog. Was there a happy ending or no?
No, there wasn't. But I do. I really would. I would really love to stay away from that topic, just in the light of this massive.
Okay,
tragedy.
Fair enough. Hey, Dennis Lehane, we really appreciate your time. Great piece in the New York Times this morning called "Messing with the Wrong City." Dennis, thanks for sharing some time with us.
And Dennis, I can't tell you what a huge fan I am of your work. You are really a talented guy, and the piece today was just terrific. And if people haven't read it, "Messing with the Wrong City," Dennis Lehane, New York Times. Thanks for taking the time, Dennis.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
Take care. Dennis Lehane. A couple of minutes, we're going to be joined by Emily Rooney, who is back downtown near where she lives. She's going to give us a report of what it looks like at the scene of, again, the finish line now crime scene in downtown Boston. You know, before we do that, Marjorie, there was a little light in the darkness yesterday. It was a press conference at 5 o'clock. I think it was the fourth press conference by law enforcement and public officials dealing with this nightmare. At the end of the press conference, not in response to a question, Deval Patrick took the microphone, the governor of the Commonwealth, and decided to tell a story about a victim and someone who helped save her. Listen to the governor.
His name is Tyler. That's all we know. Tyler. And one of the things he said to her to calm her down was to show her his own shrapnel, a wound or a scar from his own shrapnel wound from when he was in Afghanistan. Victoria very, very much wants to thank Tyler personally. So if Tyler is out there and listening or reading your reports, we would love to hear from Tyler so that we can connect him to Victoria.
It was a great story. He started by talking about Victoria who was in the hospital, who was amongst the injured. Well, if Tyler is listening, we hope you'll give us a buzz, as will others, at 877-301-8970. Or Tyler, you can email us at BPR, Boston Public Radio, at WGBH.org. But in the interim, Tyler appeared in an interview. It was run on Fox and Friends on the Fox News Channel. Here is that very same Tyler.
She was obviously in extreme pain. I just knew that I had to talk to her. If there was nothing else I could do, I could talk to her. She asked me not to leave her. She was holding my hand. Some kind of connection on a spiritual level, I would have to say. Just when I told her it was going to be okay, she believed me. I can't describe how calm she was at that point. And she said, yeah, go. Just very selfless and telling me to go help other people.
You know, there's so many connections that happen on Monday, Marjorie. You don't know what they're going to mean in the future. I mean, in a romantic way, and I don't mean in a – you know what I mean.
I know what you,
you
mean.
Hope that Victoria and Tyler are reunited.
Yes.
And have a relationship. Not unlike the story. We spoke to Carlos Arredondo yesterday, mm-hmm. who lost a son in Iraq, killed in Iraq in 2004, is Alex. His other son, Brian, killed himself in 2011. He and his wife, Melita, were at the marathon, in part because there are going to be tributes from runners to both of their kids. And Carlos was actually a Red Cross volunteer, which I didn't know till yesterday. The explosion happens, he describes to us. He rushes to help somebody. There's this iconic photo of him in a cowboy hat helping wheel someone in a wheelchair away and obviously to medical attention. The guy has obviously lost one leg. And there was a story in the New York Times yesterday, I assume other places, about the father and the son, the father of the young man who lost his legs. And you assume that Carlos, and I think the guy's name is Jeff Bauman, I hope I'm right about that, that Carlos and the elder Jeff and the younger Jeff and Melita, Carlos's wife, will connect too. So amidst all the carnage and horror, the hope is there'll be some positive relationships in the future. Our number is 877-301-8970. Joining us on the phone is our colleague from Greater Boston, who is back in, I guess, her home turf, downtown Boston. Hello, Emily Rooney.
Hey, Jane and Marge. I'm actually standing at the corner of Arlington and Boylston. And it's become kind of an eerie, almost like ground zero scene here. People are just standing at the end of Boylston Street, staring down the street. The hazmat presence here is just phenomenal. They're picking through every piece of garbage. We were just over at Restoration Hardware, which is open, by the way. It opened on Saturday.
Where is that? Berkeley?
It's right on Arlington, right next to Boylston. It's right the corner. Berkeley and Boylston. So it's right on the corner there. So I just went in for a second. It opened since Saturday, but the hazmat team was just picking through every bush, through the yards. So the fences from the actual race itself are still up. So the hazmat team was in there. We saw the hazmat picking through every bit of garbage up on Dartmouth Street, which is still blocked off. Everything's blocked. Newbury's open. A lot of the stores that were closed yesterday are all open. I do have one story. I can't identify who told me this because he could lose his job, but he was asked to go in yesterday to another place I can't mention, but let's put it this way, one of the big restaurants on Boylston Street, and he was the guy who went in to pick up the surveillance video from that restaurant, and he said it was just mind-numbingly just eerie. He said everything was frozen in place, hats, shoes, backpacks, purses. There was blood all over the ground in front of this particular establishment. And he obviously had an escort in because the police and the FBI were taking people in to get surveillance out of these all these establishments, and they were making their way down one by one by one. So that was clearly done yesterday.
You know, Emily, Ed Davis, the police commissioner, has said, I think at virtually every event, or at least at a couple of them, that the crime scene perimeter is being shrunk and shrunk.
Yeah.
How much of downtown Boston is off limits today?
It's almost identical. I'd say they've got two more streets open. I'm standing on Berkeley, and there may not have been a total cut through yesterday. There wasn't, but they've only shrunk it by a block here and a block there. I asked somebody about that specifically, and they said no. If it was 10 blocks yesterday, 12 yesterday, it's 10 today. It's still pretty much, and it's largely this hazmat thing. Cause they're looking for any kind of debris or you know, flesh, anything they can find. When we were standing in front of Restoration Hardware, not to be too graphic, but we were looking at the hazmat team, and we looked down, and we were standing on splattered blood, clearly from people who had run away from the scene. So there's still a lot of stuff around.
What's this for you? I mean, you've said repeatedly, you're essentially a homegirl. I mean, this is your neighborhood. I know it's, what is it, day three now? How out of body, like, is it for you to walk those streets that you walk every day for other more pleasurable purposes?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this because I'm so used to these big events where there's satellite trucks everywhere and every corner there's somebody set up if you go to a convention. But I have to say, when it's in your backyard or the back bay, and then you hear the screaming, the sirens and the police, the fire engines keep going by. And I don't know what they're doing. There are packs of people, you know, on cops on bikes. State police has this one kind of amusing moment where I'm standing with a Boston cop trying to get some information from him, and these guys come through with black jackets on. They're picking up barrels and looking into the barrels, and one of them ducked under the police tape, and the Boston cop says, hey, you can't do that, sir. And he looks over and he says, I'm a state cop.
That's a great story.
I love that.
And the Boston cop said to him, well, at least you can have some ID, you know?
Yeah, they're supposed to be flashing their badges. I always love those moments, though, when one law enforcement...
He didn't even have on a jacket that said state police.
Yeah,
so
he's supposed
like,
to...
I blame it.
We've seen a lot of snappy jackets. So you see the ATF guys with their jackets with the big yellow letters on the back and the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And you see the FBI guys with their big jackets. You know, they're talking now about these bombs being made. I mean, there's a lot of speculation, but the theory is that they're made from very attainable materials with, of course, cruelly, those nails and the little tiny ball bearings inside that created those terrible injuries. But that they were just delivered there, perhaps in a little black nylon bag. They got a picture of the black nylon bag in the paper today, and like a pressure cooker type deal.
Yeah, my guess, Marjorie, is that they will trace those pressure. If they haven't already, they know where those pressure cookers came from. First of all, it's kind of an old fashioned appliance.
Totally,
come back a little bit, but people now use those other things. I can't remember the name of them. You know, the slow cookers. They don't use the pressure cookers anymore. So it's an old-fashioned appliance. They will find, if they haven't already, where those things came from.
By the way, you're talking to a rotten cook, me, who bought a pressure cooker last year, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, before we continue with Emily Rooney, we just want to share with you that at a White House briefing, the FBI has said, as we speak, the preliminary tests indicate poisonous ricin was sent in a letter to the President of the United States, and there's no word on whether it's connected to the Boston Marathon bombing yet.
You know, back to these bombs for a second, Emily, because I read this morning also that the technique to make this particular bomb was published back in 2010 and that...
2004.
I read 2010, so maybe it was even earlier, in that magazine published by, associated with Al-Qaeda, the Inspired magazine. Yeah. So the materials are all right out there if you want to do this sort of thing.
I guess the publication was 2010, but the actual recipe for this came about in 2004 because it was very common in Iraq and Afghanistan. I went back and did some research on that yesterday, and it was available by then. But yeah, it's all these common tools. You know, the one thing they didn't have, I don't know, I just going by what I've been told, they didn't have sophisticated gunpowder. They didn't have what they call C4, which is a military gunpowder. They had something less explosive, and they also said they didn't tamp it well enough, which is why it exploded so low, and it was relatively low impact, and that's why there were so many lower limb injuries as well.
Emily, thank you so much for doing your investigative reporting down there. I hope you don't get anyone in trouble for the great information you told us about what's going on in those restaurants.
Thanks, Emily.
That was a good one.
Right, Emily, thank you. Emily Rooney, of course, will be talking again about the tragedy at the Boston Marathon tonight on Greater Boston, 7 o'clock, WGBH. I think in most towns, it's certainly Channel 2 in Boston and Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. I think it is in most places. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. If you'd like to talk about 2 days later, the tragedy at the Boston Marathon, we're going to be joined by doctors, by people that know a lot about bonds, by people that know about how this is going to affect the legislation for gun control that's going to be taken up this afternoon in Congress, 877-301-8970.
I know we're not going to talk about the gun control thing until the next hour, but the fact that some people who oppose stronger gun control legislation are suggesting that what happened in Boston is an excuse for not to do things like broader background checks, even if they're not universal, is just, it is pathetic. Our number again is 877-301-8970. We are going to talk to a lot of people today, but throughout the day, if there's something you want to talk about, if you are one, we had a call yesterday. In fact, can we play a piece of this for a minute? The final call we had yesterday, and sadly we were short on time, was Tom from Revere. Tom was a person who said that he was one of the 170-plus victims. He talked about his whole situation. Here was a brief snippet from Tom from yesterday.
Please bear with me. This is very difficult, but I've been told I need to talk about it. So, sure. I was at the I was watching the race yesterday in front of the Atlantic Fish Company when the second bomb went off and threw me to the ground. I felt the heat. I had the concussion, so I'm still not able to hear very well. But I also, having been knocked to the ground, wasn't sure what was happening. Until a few seconds later when I noticed a pool of blood underneath me on the sidewalk.
I think
I scurried around a planter, which was sitting in front of Atlantic Fish, which kind of designates their sidewalk cafe, and hid on the other side of it in case another explosion was going to happen. None did, so after about 30 seconds and another pool of blood under me, I decided I'd better walk somewhere. So I started walking up Fairfield Street towards Newberry, and the most impressive thing was two people, just people standing by watching the race, ran to my assistance because I wasn't walking too well.
Oh, I think we're losing that. Are we losing that? In any case, that was Tom from Revere, who was kind enough to call us yesterday and apparently is out of the hospital. And well, can we take a call or two before we go to the break? Good, let's do that. Let's go to Sheila Norton. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy
and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Sheila.
I thought the show yesterday was superb.
Thank
you for giving us the information. Two things. One is, Jim, I sent you your email. Yelp is saying that today there's many, many restaurants in Boston that today will donate a lot of their proceeds to the fund. And I think it lists. The email I sent will list to you the restaurants.
That's great, brother. That's great. And the fund you're talking about is the fund that was announced first by Tom Menino at the 5 o'clock press conference, then the governor. What is it called? OneBostonFund.org. We should double-check that, I'm saying to my colleagues, to get the actual the web address, so that if people want to make a contribution, they can and probably should. I'm sorry, Sheila, continue.
That's okay. And secondly, I've been reminded when I watched the people helping and all the care that's been given at the hospitals, it reminded me of the Coconut Grove incident that we had. I believe that was the name of the fire.
Yes, yeah. Coconut Grove fire.
Years ago, and we will be a better, stronger Boston. Every time you walk out of a building, that the doors go out forward, that's all as a result of a tragedy. And I think we'll learn. They have salves now at the hospitals as a result of the burn victims. Then we will have a stronger, stronger Boston because we'll learn from it. And I think we've learned about tragedy in the past, and I'm just so proud of everyone. I'm from Pennsylvania, but I'm a Bostonian through and through, and I've never seen such caring that was shown, and I just am so proud of the city.
By the way, I'm from Pennsylvania, and I'm a Bostonian through and through. Sheila, I share those sentiments. Thanks so much for the call. By the way, I got the name backwards. If you want to make a contribution to help with all the fallout from Monday, the website is one, as in O-N-E, fundboston.org.
And there's also the first responders, the police, firefighters, and the EMTs in Boston have set up a $50,000.
Yeah, they all contributed.
That's right, reward fund for any information or the capture of the person or persons who did this. Okay, what can we learn from the explosives that went off on Monday at the Boston Marathon finish line? We take a forensic look at the components that went into killing three and injuring 180. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
When news happens, it happens to all of us.
This is a great family event.
You live here, you work here, and we do too.
People come in here from Framingham, and they come up from the Cape, and they come from, you know, Denver. And
so when news happens, we're here to keep you connected to information and to each other.
This race is never going to be the same again.
89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting Pulitzer Prize winner Glengarry Glen Ross by David Mamet, running April 25th to May 19th. For more information, you can visit mrt.org. That's mrt.org. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books.
I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Joining us on the line from D.C. to go over what we can learn from the current evidence that was broadcast yesterday at the 5 o'clock press conference and what it tells us about Monday's explosions and explosives is Patrick Chagnon. He's a counterterrorism training coordinator. He's worked for the Connecticut State Police as well as the U.S. State Department. He's now president of something called Blue Line Risk Mitigation Group. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. And you, unfortunately, it's under bad circumstances every time you get a call to do an interview. So, but I'm happy to share my information with you.
Well, thank you.
Well, Patrick, what do we know at this point?
Well, I think from the baseline, it's whatever we could pull from the media. Unfortunately, as my career in law enforcement ended, so did instant contacts for fresh information. I get information just like everybody else now through the media. And ultimately right now is still very, very basic in nature as investigators start going through the long process of identifying the components of the device and how they're put together and ultimately tying that into a particular tactic that was used by either that individual or a potential group.
I want to talk a little bit about what the bombs tell us, if anything, about who might be the bomber or bombers. Originally, we were told by people, everybody from Tom Ridge, former head of Homeland Security, that it was a rudimentary bomb. Then some of the local leaders said it was a crude device, which suggests that it was a domestic terrorism. Then we read yesterday that the explosive device was not dissimilar to IEDs, which are almost exclusively used in the Middle East. So that suggested international terror. But at the same time, nobody's claimed credit for this, which ordinarily is the case, that they do claim credit when it's international terrorists. So amidst all that conflicting stuff, I don't want you to irresponsibly speculate, but if you can responsibly do so, what does it tell us about the men, or people behind this thing?
Well, right now, it basically tells us nothing until you can gather all the intelligence you can, either through the intelligence communities, evidence at the scene, and witnesses. One of the things that we need to do right from the get-go is backtrack a little bit. That term IED is really all that means is an improvised explosive device.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you're taking components from the environment and you are customizing an explosive device to fit a particular mission that you are looking to achieve. In this case, obviously attacking large amounts of people outside in an outside environment. So when somebody puts a device like that together, generally they're looking for four different components is what you need. You need a power source, you need an initiator, you need some sort of explosive, and you need some way to actually detonate what we call a switching component. So you know, from the look of the media, right away I was thinking a low explosive, which would be a black powder or some sort of powder element. They're sort of a burning type of explosive. But when you put it into an IED format, any good bomb technician will tell you that when you're approaching something, even if you know it's a low explosive component, it's always going to be treated as if it was a high explosive. And that's how explosives are generally graded, low or high. Low, they burn. High, they detonate.
Hey, Patrick, before we get to your area of expertise, which is crime prevention, which I think is what everybody's worried about, we want to catch the bad guys, but then we want to ensure the bad guys don't succeed in the future. When you read that these ingredients of this bomb could probably be bought for $100 or thereabouts, and virtually all of them are as common as the day is long, putting aside video and pictures, which hopefully will lead to something, getting anywhere from what the composition of that bomb to the bomber is almost an impossible task, isn't it, just from the bomb itself?
Well, it's interesting. Again, when you talk about the packaging of the device itself, in other words, what the components were actually ultimately put into, really do lead investigators to a lot of different possibilities. You can gain a lot even from the power source if they were using a Duracell battery. There are numbers, there are manufacturing codes that investigators can track down.
Wow.
It's an alarm clock. It's very time-consuming. It does take a little bit of time for forensic examiners to pull that information and put it together. But ultimately, right now, I think investigators are looking at the primary things that they could collect and try to identify a perpetrator. Later on, about where they bought it and how they put it together, that's great for prosecution purposes, and we have time on our side for that. Investigators right now want to find out who's responsible, just in case there are potential deployment strategies for later on down the road.
You know, Patrick, you've said, many other people have said this too, and I think you have expressed this notion that many of these components, you know, in these bombs, you can purchase them legally, but that you can tell if you're living next door to someone that they may be doing this sort of nefarious work in their house. How do you know that?
Well, you know, that's a very, very good point right there. And it's one of the things that we try to teach not only just law enforcement, but private sector individuals, even just private citizens. It's what I call actionable knowledge. You know what is normal in your environment.
Right.
You know the characteristics in your environment. What do you do when something pops out of the abnormal area where you go, geez, I wonder why that occurred? Do you keep that information? You share that information, or you totally dismiss it. And as a culture, I was really reminded of this by my daughter when she was trick or treating a while back, and we stopped by a house, and she did not want to go to that house. And I was wondering why, and she made an observation that an intoxicated person came off the front porch, made a gesture toward her, which made her feel unsafe, and she immediately retreated. Well, we all have that fight or flight syndrome built in us. But as we get older, you and I suppress it. We try to justify certain things that are going on in an environment and try to dismiss it. In today's world, we really need to start questioning, does this have something to do with some sort of nefarious activity that might be going on in the planning stage?
But what do you do with that? What do you do with that, Patrick? You can't call. I mean, I remember the classic story in the Columbine shootings that Eric Harris, the shooter, one of the shooters in that case, was building pipe bombs in his garage. His parents claimed they had no idea. But even if you did see somebody building a pipe bomb in their garage, you're going to call the police? I mean,
I'd call the police.
Well, maybe you would call the police, but I'm not sure the police would do anything because a crime has not yet been committed. It's not illegal to build a. Maybe it is. Is it illegal to build a?
It is illegal to build a device. So that's number one. But, the advice I give people is, especially when I was on the job with the Connecticut State Police, is if there's anything that you think that is out of the ordinary, leave that to the professionals to determine whether it's not. New York City has a great program that they utilize with their citizens. You call in the TIPS line in New York City, it goes into a database. And you have the option of either giving your name or leaving a tip anonymously. And that tip will be followed up either way. But if you leave your name, an investigator will call you back and let you know, hey, this led to something. I can't share with you exactly what it led to, but we also want to let you know that what you provided was very helpful. Or B, it wasn't helpful, but we still want to encourage you to use this in the future.
Hey,
a lot of people think they're inundating law enforcement or their Homeland Security components with useless information. From an intelligence standpoint, it's not useless. More bits of information we could provide, the better.
Patrick, we're really short on time. Just last very quick question for me. From what I gather from listening to you and reading a little bit about you, you think public education is probably one of the most important ingredients that's been missing in this kind of crime prevention in this country, right?
I do. And as I said on a different interview, think of this as your basic crime thing. Terrorism is a crime. If you look at communities that have really low crime issues in their jurisdiction, it's because the community is involved at every level, at every aspect. And we could beat terrorism, but we have to think the same way we do with traditional crime.
Hey, Patrick Shagnon, we really appreciate your time. He's the president of the Blue Line Risk Mitigation Group. Patrick, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you. Of course, with these explosions, we all know it became 3 deaths and 180 injured people. Many of those victims were taken to Brigham and Women's Hospital. Joining us on the line with an update on how they are doing is the Surgeon in Chief at the Brigham, Dr. Michael Zinner. Doctor, thank you for joining us.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.
Is everyone still there? First of all, how many people are at the Brigham, and is everyone still there? Anyone been released?
Well, we had 31 casualties brought in on Monday. 15 of those were admitted to the hospital, and 15 were discharged but seen immediately on Tuesday for follow-up care. So we've got about 15 that were seen, and we're left with probably about 6 or 7 that are still in the hospital.
Yeah, doctor,
we've heard a lot about amputations after this tragedy, but I'm guessing that in 2013 you can do, I mean, obviously not as well, but there's a lot that can be done to help you walk again, even if you've lost both legs.
That's correct. I mean, We all have in mind the Olympic sprinter from from South Africa who had an amazing recovery from a childhood amputations. We're fortunate though that not all of the patients required amputations. That many of them had blast and fragment industries and mangled extremities that were reconstructed. In the operating room, and fortunately, they're still doing well.
You know, doctor, my headphones weren't functioning for about 30 seconds. So if you already answered this, my apologies, and we'll move on. You said 15 still in the hospital. Of that list, how many are in critical, and are you worried about losing further lives? Are you confident that people are stable enough that you can save everybody?
So we have 4 that we would still call critical. And it looks like those that have been admitted to us or were seen by us, all of them are going to survive. And we're thankful for that. We're grateful to this enormously successful EMT service, Boston EMS, that just we were in a horrible accident like this. We were blessed with having so many personnel so close to the scene.
And we understand people were quite prepared for this, but how do the EMTs or who's ever in charge, how do they decide which 31 go to your place, which X number go to another place? Is it because of specialties in each house?
No,
or is it something, is it proximity? What is it?
Well, we have, we drill for this, and the decision about where they go is essentially done by EMS, knowing that you can't overwhelm one service, you can't overwhelm one hospital. So we all got about the same number of casualties by Boston EMT.
What was it like when you were there and all of a sudden the victims of this horror show finally started appearing at your place? What was your personal reaction, not your medical reaction?
Well, so it's a complex answer. It sounds like it should be simple. You sort of, the adrenaline starts rushing, and you go into high gear, and you're not thinking so much of the person. You're focused on saving lives, limbs, and resuscitation. And then it's after that period, after the operating room, after the patients recover, that the adrenaline goes down, and you start saying, oh, my God, this is a young person who yesterday was a high school athlete or something like that, and their lives are going to be changed forever. And that's when it sinks into the care providers. And it does that to everybody.
Well, there was a very sad anecdote with sort of, I suppose, in the situation, a happy ending, about a 17-year-old from Lowell High School who was bleeding to death and near death when she reached the hospital. And then you were able to save her. And that is how? By massive blood transfusions at the scene? Or how is that done, doctor?
Well, it's not. You can't do blood transfusions at the scene. They're not prepared for that. But the EMTs can start an IV and get fluid running. And we knew, remember, the medical tents were set up for, like, last year. If you remember last year at the marathon, there was about 200 patients treated for heat stroke.
Right.
And they are often treated with IVs or fluids. So that's one way to do it. The other critical thing is what we learned from our war experiences, and that is the use of tourniquets. So on the extremities, battlefield casualties can be saved by the use of a tourniquet so they don't bleed to death. And I think you saw in some of the shots and films from the scene that civilians began to use whatever they could as tourniquets to save these people from bleeding to death.
We spoke to one of those citizens yesterday, Carlos Arredondo, with a cowboy hat that helped put a tourniquet around the leg of, I guess his name is Jeff Bauman. How long have you been doing what you do, Dr. Zinner?
Well, I've been doing this for about 30 years.
You ever seen anything like this before?
Never. This was a horrible mass casualty scene. I've been at the Brigham for 20 years, and in that period of time, we've never seen anything like this. This is the kind of stuff you see in Baghdad. This is the kind of stuff you see, you know, in Israel or Tel Aviv. This is not the kind of stuff we see in America.
We're actually going to talk to someone who's been in Baghdad and places like that in just a couple of minutes.
You know, Doctor, one last question for me. I had the opportunity to interview for the Boston Herald, where I also work, a nurse at the Brigham, Tracy Capello, who had an incredible story. She was very modest, didn't want to brag, but she divides her time between the labor and delivery room on the fifth floor at the Brigham and the emergency room. And on Monday, she began her shift in labor and delivery. The emergency situation developed where they needed more help at the emergency room, went down and spent 5 hours down in the emergency room, goes back up to the fifth floor and delivers a baby at 10 minutes of 11 right before her shift's end. And, I mean, the contrast in that as a medical person, it was just stunning to me.
I read your piece in the Herald, and you're right. I think it's a stunning example of what people do when they're called to duty. You know, when we figured out that this was a mass casualty, we put out an all hands on deck, and we started getting help from everybody. Everybody that was part of our system came in. Our residents, our staff couldn't use cell phones, but they could text each other, and they began a text round robin to get everybody in so that we could run seven operating rooms at the same time with seven full teams. It was just, my hat's off to the entire staff of this place.
Dr. Zinner, before you go away, I'm sure you're not in the speculation business, but I'm going to put you in it anyway, if you don't mind for a second. We all know what we've had and we have in terms of medical facilities in Boston. I think I read in the last day or two there's something like six high-level trauma centers within a mile or two of the finish line of the marathon. Had that not been the case, had this happened 5 miles away or 10 miles away or in a city that doesn't have a medical infrastructure like Boston, what would we be talking about today?
Well, again, one of the lessons we learned from war is that there's this golden hour, and you've got to get patients resuscitated and into a facility very quickly. And if you don't, you have a higher casualty rate, you have a higher loss of life and loss of limb. So it's hard to speculate if we didn't have trauma centers, but in places that don't, They're not as well prepared, they're not as drilled, and they're not as experienced, and I'm afraid we would have had more loss of life and limb.
Dr. Michael Zinner, Surgeon in Chief at Brigham and Women's, really thank you for your work, and we thank you for your time this afternoon.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, how do we process bombings in our backyard versus bombings across the globe? We're going to have that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH. Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio.
Some companies test for illegal drugs. We know that. Some now are testing for what's legal.
Before they are hired, they have a drug test that they take that detects nicotine use.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Freakonomics of Smoker Discrimination and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace. It's from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Private Bank, committed to providing a personalized approach to banking and investing. Boston Private Bank. This is your time. This is your private bank. More information available at bostonprivatebank.com. And Skinner, presenting their auction of Asian works of art on April 20th at the Skinner Boston Gallery. The auction presents a diverse selection of art forms from China, Japan, and Korea. More info and online bidding at skinnerinc.com.
There's a piece, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, I'm sorry, with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Piece in the Global Post this morning, Boston Marathon attack, when home is the target. And the writer talks about rattling off at least 20 cities in the last 20 years where he had covered bombings, but now it's in his home. Joining us on the line is the guy who wrote that piece. He's the executive editor and co-founder of the Global Post, Charlie Sennett. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thanks, Jim.
Hey, Charlie, thank you for joining us. So tell us, as a journalist who's covered many war zones for many years, what is the difference when this sort of carnage hits home?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing you notice is these images all feel the same. I mean, that's the part that really was crashing over me as someone who's covered so many of these. You know, it's always the same blood-spattered shock and the same twisted metal and sort of incredible expressions of grief and shock combined. But I think what makes it profoundly different is rushing to a scene as a journalist covering a foreign capital and having it hit so close to something that all of us who are from Boston think of as one of the greatest days in the city. You know, this wasn't a foreign capital in conflict like the many times I've covered bombings in Baghdad or Kabul, or even Jerusalem, where there's a profound insurgency and a great tension in that holy city. This was like an expression of life, right? This was the place and the day when we think about just this great collective goodwill and what a great city it is on a beautiful day. And I think it just felt profoundly different. And I've been trying to parse through, why does that matter? And I think what it means is when it's your home, it's just really different. You know, I was in Afghanistan so quickly after 9/11 that I didn't have a chance to feel the emotion at home of that in New York City. I was in the field. It's the first time I've been involved in a bombing where I was really, you know, genuinely worried about my own family, my own loved ones, some of whom were at that marathon, like so many people listening. But I don't know, it brings perspective for me. I've covered so many of these. I see so many similarities in the forensic investigation, the signature of the bombing, how they're going to pursue these suspects, what process will lead. But all of that's just fundamentally different.
Well, you know, Charlie, I've thought about this a lot. We are just geographically very lucky. We have the Atlantic on one side. We have the Pacific on the other side. We're a long way from Europe. We're even further from the Middle East. And when these terrible things happen in Europe, which is not obviously the Middle East, you know, the IRA bombings in London or the Red Brigades years ago in Italy, it was far away. And we had this wonderful isolation geographically. That's what was so scary to me about 9/11, and now even more scary about this. Are it doesn't seem to matter anymore because we have been infiltrated.
I think that's right. And I think it shouldn't be any different, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, these are innocent people who've been killed or injured. These are people with an insane and twisted belief in some expression of some fundamentalistic belief, whether that's international or domestic terrorism, we don't know yet. But whatever it is, it's not going to make any more sense when we find out who it is, that they would actually try to kill innocent people. So why is it different is something I've been really trying to get at. And I think it's as simple as it's your home. It's your family. It's your friends. It's your loved ones. And, you know, I think that's just going to change the way maybe I cover some of these bombings around the world. I sort of hope, God forbid, I don't have to do that anymore. I hope they decrease or end, and I hope my time covering them is less and less. But I think it's just been a profound difference for me. And I think one of the things I see as another one of those similarities in all this is that great cities, really great cities like Madrid, and I covered the bombings there, or London from the 7/7 bombings in 2005, Jerusalem for sure, Belfast. These are great cities with a great spirit of resiliency, and I watched all of them go through these horrific chapters in their history of a terrorist bombing or series of bombings, and I think I've learned that these great cities bounce back, and I have great faith that Boston will do the same. This is a tough city. It's a city that won't allow those who wanted to sow fear to achieve their results. I think it's a city that we'll have that same distinction as those other great cities I mentioned about bouncing back.
Well, you know, earlier today we talked to Dennis Lehane, who wrote a piece you probably read in the New York Times, Messing with the Wrong City, who has a similar take on this.
It's great.
As you do. I want to pick up on something you said a minute ago. We're talking to Charlie Sennett, who's the executive editor of the great Global Post, globalpost.com. Is how will it change how you, assuming that you have the misfortune to have to cover the 21st of those bombings around the world, how will it change your perspective on that, Charlie Sennett, when it has happened in your own backyard?
I think it reminds me that as journalists out there covering these stories, that those human stories are not just part of the feature angle to a hard news event. They are what matters. They are the stories that tell you the truth of how a people are reacting to a horrific situation and a terrible and heinous crime. And how a society responds to that is something that I want to pay much closer attention to, particularly how individuals respond. Look at this city. Look at how it responded. Look at the number of runners who came to the assistance of those who were injured, the number of people along the sidewalk who pitched in. We've heard Mayor Menino talk about this. We've heard the governor talk about it. We've heard the president talk about it. But I think it's a proud moment for our city, and I feel like I guess I'm going to try to bring that spirit to the coverage that we do around the world of these kinds of terrible events, not to forget that in the end of the day, it's not about the terrorists. It's about the people who endure the attack and how they bring their own dignity and their own strength to recovering from it and moving on.
Hey, Charlie Sennett, before we let you go, just based on your experience and not only covering what happened, but having, I'm sure in many of those cases, covered the finding of the people who perpetrated these unthinkable acts, what's your two-day in speculation or insight into what we're talking about here?
Well, you know, I've been trying to follow this as best I can through sources here who are extremely busy and hard to reach, but there is definitely a sense that they're making some progress in this investigation. Where that's going to go, we don't know. You know, I'll remind everyone of the obvious here, which is it was April 19th in 1995 when I was told to immediately go from the Middle East. I had just gotten home, and they said, we need you to go to Oklahoma City today, April 19th, to cover this bombing in Oklahoma City, because we're sure it's Middle East-related. When I got there, of course, we started to cover the story, and it wasn't related to the Middle East at all. It was Timothy McVeigh. It was the Patriot Movement, and they put great significance in the date, Patriots Day,
right,
April 19th. So I want to make just as much caution this time that now that we know it happened on Patriots Day, and I think some of us who've covered these kinds of terrorist instincts and look at the crude nature of the bomb, we lean towards thinking, wow, this is probably domestic, probably Second Amendment fundamentalists. It's probably the Patriot Movement. But we have learned, or I hope we have learned, don't jump to conclusions. Even though I think that is where the arrows are pointing, I think we have to wait until we have solid information, and we don't want to be quick to judge.
Hey, Charlie, sent a great piece this morning in your own operation, globalpost.com. The story by Charlie was Boston Marathon attack when home is the target. Thanks for your time, Charlie.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Marjorie.
Thank you very much, Charlie, for being with us. Our number is 877-301-8970 if you'd like to join us where we're talking today mostly about the aftermath of the Boston Marathon tragedy. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. We're going to be joined in a few minutes by Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe, and we are going to get to your calls and your emails. Again, 877-301-8970. 8970. Brian McGroy weighs in next on this news and the news we've missed while we've been focusing on the marathon. Stay tuned to WGBH 89.7.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Brian McGroy, the editor of the Boston Globe, will join us in a handful of minutes. In the interim, we'd like to hear from you at 877-301-8970, or you can do the email thing. It's BPR, standing for Boston Public Radio, at WGBH.org. You know what's really interesting to me?
What?
You have people like Charlie Sennett, who we just spoke to a minute ago, who, as he says, has covered bombings and their aftermath in 20 cities throughout the world. You have Dennis Lehane, an internationally known great novelist, who joined us at the top of the last hour. Both Boston kids,
right,
essentially, who the connection to their hometown is so deep and so real, and their confidence in the resiliency of Bostonians is just, to me, is so upbeat. It's got a great feel to it.
We've had this conversation in different contexts before. That it, when it happens to you in your home, it changes everything. That's what the Newtown parents have said. It happened to us here in this beautiful hometown. We've had this conversation about crime in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the murders in Boston take place in a very small part of Boston.
Do.
It's in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan, where you have teenagers being gunned down with horrific regularity. And we've discussed the fact that if that were happening in the streets of Wellesley, or that were happening in where I live in Brookline, we probably have the National Guard
on
the streets.
Yes, within about a minute.
But because it hasn't happened to people that live there, they may have tremendous empathy, but it's just not the same as when you're worried about your own kid walking from your house three blocks away to go to school or to go to their church. It's very, very different.
You know what's also – we're going to get to your calls in 1 second at 877-301-8970. You know, in many ways, this feels like it happened a century ago, even though it was only literally 2 days ago. But think about how much hasn't happened. We finally identified the three people who were dead as a mm-hmm. result of this this monster or set of monsters. We know a little bit about some of the 170 to 180 victims, people who were injured, but so much more of that is going to come out. We know nothing about the people behind this to begin with. The point being, we've really in some ways just begun this chapter, this saga. It's going to be with us for a really long time.
We mentioned before that there's going to be this prayer service tomorrow with President Obama coming to town, Holy Cross Cathedral in the South End. There were also two vigils last night. One was at Garvey Park in Dorchester,
yeah,
near where Martin Richards lived. He's, of course, is the 8-year-old boy who was killed in the blast. His mother was hit in the head. She's seriously injured. His sister was hurt in the leg. She's seriously injured. The father is okay. There was also, I thought this was, you know, not a big deal, but kind of a lovely tribute to Boston, too. You mentioned the Yankees.
We have a caller about it. Let's take the caller if we can.
Oh, about the
Jason
Yankees?
Jason from Salem. That's exactly what you want to talk about. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Jason.
Hi, welcome, you guys.
Hey, welcome to you, too.
Yeah, I wanted to just mention that I heard about the Yankees playing Sweet Caroline on NECN, and I saw footage.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing is that I rarely tear up at all. But seeing all the fans in the stands just smiling and singing Sweet Caroline, it brought a tear to my eye. And it was very, very poignant for me. And I would hope that if, heaven forbid, that if something like this ever happened to New York, Fenway Park would play New York, New York by Frank Sinatra.
Whoa, wait a second. You would hope that would happen. That's exactly what happened. I think it was Frank Sinatra's version of New York, New York after 9/11. It was played at Fenway Park, Jason.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
And not only that, Jason, but the Yankees displayed their logo side by side with the Boston Red Sox B and the huge message, United We Stand. And the Boston City flag flew at half-mast at the New York City Hall in Manhattan, which is kind of a nice gesture, too. What was that great documentary about 9/11, the Yankees games, and right after 9/11?
Oh, right after 9/11. Well, also, when George Bush takes to the mound.
And threw out the first pitch, and he did throw a pretty good pitch. Obama did not throw such a great pitch.
He bounced it, Barack Obama did.
I think he threw like a girl, kind of. It wasn't very good. But it's a fantastic documentary. We'll get the name of it before the end of the show about the Yankees and Mets playing in New York City.
You know, Jason, I have to say, I don't tear up that much either. I had the exact same reaction you did. And you know, what's so interesting is there's so many more serious gestures that people make in respect for what happened here on Monday. But it was that little piece that had a profound effect on me, too. So I'm really glad you called. Jason, thank you so much. I hate the song Sweet Caroline. I hate that they keep playing it at Fenway. But everything changed when the Yankees did it in my senses. That'll give it a little additional life here. Our number's 877-301-8970. BPR at WGBH.org is our email. Any reflections? It's not even two full days yet. It's 46 plus hours since this horror happened. And, you know, everybody, to use the word, who used this word? Was it Dennis Lane said still processing this thing? And you really are. There's so many angles to this, so many pieces to this. We finally heard detailed information from the head of the FBI here, DeLaurier. I have to say, nobody looks more, maybe other than the former Middlesex County DA, who you described as Elliot Ness.
Jerry Leone.
He does remind me
of Elliot Ness.
I believe he's left or is leaving. But yeah. DeLaurier has such an FBI image. He's disclosed virtually no information until yesterday when he started filling in a lot of the blanks on the on what was in the bomb, what it was composed of. And they continue to say repeatedly, I guess a variation of what we've heard for years, if you saw something, say something. The conventional wisdom appears to be it's going to be videos, it's going to be photographs that thousands of people took right before and at the time of the explosion that may help solve this thing.
Well, I think it's a good idea that the FBI is looking FBI-ish because, as you know, they need some rehabilitation in Boston as we await the trial of Whitey Bulger, who managed to corrupt great swaths of the FBI in Boston, and I think people lost a lot of faith in them as well they should. They did say, though, there were stories in the paper the FBI was talking about and their sources were talking about whether these were timing devices on these bombs, whether they were set off with remote control.
Well, they wouldn't answer the question about the circuit board thing. A lot of people are saying the circuit board was found, which detonated the devices.
Yes.
DeLaurier refused to answer the question.
But the idea that the bombs may have been fashioned from these pressure cookers, I mean, is just I just don't think of pressure cookers in those terms. And then, as we know,
have you seen the photographs, by the way?
The little piece, the twisted metal from the pressure cooker. And that, of course, the bombs were filled with nails and small ball bearings like buckshot to increase the carnage.
Let's go to Mike. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Oh, thank you. Hey, I just want to say real quick, you know, this is an absolute horrible thing that, you know, I was a couple blocks away, but let's not forget the folks in Homeland Security and DOD that put their life on the line every day in situations just like this, you know, overseas and at home to protect so this doesn't happen elsewhere.
Well, also, that is for sure, but let's celebrate, as a lot of people have, the people who put their lives at risk on that particular day. You know, it became almost a tired expression when we heard after 9/11, while everybody was running away, the first responders are running towards the horror at the World Trade Center. But the exact same thing on a smaller scale happened on Monday afternoon. And those, I hate when everybody becomes a hero, but the reality is they were heroes. They were courageous and saved a lot of lives. And by the way, it's not just first responders. As we learn, a lot of civilians, a lot of real people who just happened to be there, put their own lives at risk in an effort to save their fellow men and women. And it doesn't get much better than that.
Definitely.
Sorry.
There are heroes out there every day, you know, just those
yeah, we got
out
it.
Here in the U.S.
Mike, thank you kindly for the call. We appreciate it.
Up next, we're going to be joined by the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrow. We have him with us every Wednesday afternoon. Hey, Brian.
Marjorie, how are you?
I'm okay. You know, before you put on your newspaper editor's hat, you're a local kid. Well, you're not a kid anymore, but you're a local guy. You grew up here. You've probably covered the marathon for years. I don't know, maybe even ran it, Brian. What's this like for you as a Boston guy?
Well, it's extraordinary. And are you aware of the news that's breaking right now? We just posted on our website.
I'm reading it this second. Tell us, Brian.
Well, we just posted on our website that there is an image of a suspect carrying a black bag at the second bombing scene, which was outside of the Forum restaurant on Boylston Street across from the Lord & Taylor department store. From what we gather, it is a pretty clear image, authorities are saying that they are, quote, very close right now, end of quote, and maybe putting out an identity or the image as early as this afternoon.
This is, we assume, from the footage inside the restaurant, or do we know?
Right now, there's a distinct possibility that I am told that there's a very good video camera, surveillance camera at the Lord & Taylor store. The image may be from that camera. I haven't confirmed that yet, but our understanding is that there's a camera at the Lord & Taylor that was trained on that area.
Milton Valencia, one of your people, has tweeted, I'll read it, what he said, authorities have image of a suspect carrying and perhaps dropping a black bag at the second bombing scene.
And do we know about what time this was, Brian?
I don't have that right now. I mean, this is literally unfolding as we're talking here. That's why I'm a little late getting on with you.
That's okay.
A very good Brian, is your understanding, they had said yesterday when they concluded the 5 o'clock press event, they said that, I believe Delorier said, the FBI guy here said that they would hope to be back to the public sometime mid-afternoon today. Is your understanding that's what's next? Sometime mid-afternoon we're going to hear from them?
Yeah, I think they had, and forgive me if I'm not clear on the time, I thought it was a 4 o'clock briefing schedule mm-hmm. for today. And I suspect, you know, they're probably preparing something right now. Literally this thing is unfolding as we're talking, so I suspect you're going to see something sooner rather than later.
We'll let you go fairly quickly because you're in the middle of this, but did you get to answer Marjorie's question? Because I was reading the Boston.com. What is the answer? Forget editor hat. What was this like for you?
It's completely surreal. I mean, as somebody who grew up here, it's the word is overused, but it's an iconic event. It's the first day of spring, traditionally. It's the whole package with the Red Sox game, always at 11 o'clock up at Fenway, with the events out in Lexington, and with the running of the marathon. And it's a great day always to be a Bostonian, and you can never imagine in a million years. I mean, you put this up with the July 4th festivities on the Esplanade, you can never imagine in a million years that something like this could go on, and it will take a long time to get your head around this.
You know, a lot of people have compared it to July 4th, but I would argue in some ways it's even better, and I don't know if better is the right word, because everybody gets this to celebrate July 4th in this country. Only Massachusetts people get the combination of Patriots Day, which is obviously our holiday, and the marathon, and the whole Red Sox thing. I know you're the boss now and you have different responsibilities. Do you spend any time thinking about what you would have written about had you had your column on the front page of the Metro section, Brian?
What might it have been? First of all, I think that we've had great columnists writing great columns about this. Kirk, have you been reading Kevin Cullen? He has been terrific. Yvonne Abraham had a really good column today. Marjorie, you had a great column today.
She did.
I've been dwelling on other things. But, one of the things that strikes me after an event like this is that much of the world moves on. We saw people move on emotionally from Newtown. We're seeing it in the on Capitol Hill now, where they can't get the most basic reform legislation passed on gun control.
Staggering.
And, you know, you see all the marathoners heading out to the airport, leaving town. The people that were, you know, on the route that day watching are going on with their lives. But, you know, for many people, this is an intimate and awful occurrence because you're going to have, first of all, you have three people who are dead. You have people who are going to be using prosthetics for the rest of their lives. You have people who are emotionally damaged for the rest of their lives. Even though it's an international event, a world event, the pain here is going to be enduring and incredibly intimate, and it's just really sad to think about.
You know, Brian, may I change gears for just one second?
Sure.
The marathon has overwhelmed everything this week, but there is a really important story today that broke for those who were concerned about the probation department and those who were concerned about political hires in the probation department. When you need very skilled and qualified people to be probation officers, as you reported today and the Herald reported today, John O'Brien, the former commissioner of the Massachusetts Probation Department, was found not guilty yesterday in Suffolk Superior Court of multiple counts, and basically that he was getting people, political hires, jobs. There's another federal trial to come, but to me this was devastating because the probation department had been so corrupted by this O'Brien character, and now he's acquitted.
Yeah, I mean, Marjorie, I would disagree a little bit with that. I don't find it devastating because the Globe and its reporting, Spotlight Team reporting, took a hard look at basically how the probation department, a pretty critical state department, was being run like this, crazy enterprise. And if the goal was to correct what had gone wrong, I think we've done much of that already. I think that's happened. And, you know, well, it would have been interesting to see him convicted of crimes. I think what's more important for the people of Massachusetts is that the probation department has been, will continue to be, on a good path. And with new leadership and new rules, new regulations, reforms, and I think the state benefits from that.
The difference between you, Brian, and Marjorie and me is we're pound of flesh people as opposed to, hey, Brian, just a couple of quick things and we'll let you go. Just go back to the thing on Boston.com, possible suspect seen an image at second bomb site. That image is not yet available, is it?
It's not out yet. What we're being told is that very close to the words that have been used and that we may well see something this afternoon.
Okay, Brian, last thing for me, it's about the everything else going on in the world. It's even hard to talk about these things when something so massive happened in our midst. We are, I think, 13 days away from primaries in a pretty important election in Massachusetts. And campaign suspended. This is obviously, these are the Senate, U.S. Senate primaries to replace John Kerry. Campaign suspended. You know, I hearken back. I don't know if I got the facts right. You or Marjorie would correct me. Didn't we have a special election in Boston? I think it was Steve Lynch's, what became Steve Lynch's
9/11.
Seat.
9/11, yes.
Yeah,
and it went on.
And ultimately, the decision was, I thought it should be postponed. I think
election.
The governor, it was Swift, was
I
it?
I think it was the Secretary of State.
Maybe
wasn't
it was Galvin,
Galvin,
decided to do it and was the right thing. But realistically speaking, this has a profound impact on which man is going to be sitting as the junior senator from Massachusetts, does it not?
Oh, it's got a huge impact. I mean, a picture. If the campaign had essentially been suspended in the Coakley-Brown race, Coakley probably would have won.
That's a fabulous point, by the way.
And now there's no room for anyone to gain momentum. Usually the candidates who need momentum are obviously the ones who are running from behind. And that's not going to happen right now. There's no oxygen in the air for this kind of race. Not that there was a lot anyways. I mean, we've been bombarded with politics here for several years running, and it would have been tough anyways, but now it's particularly tough.
Well, because I'm assuming you as the editor, and I don't want to speak for your counterpart Joe Sciacca at the Herald, but I'm assuming the responsibility you both feel as you get closer to primary day is to focus more, even if the public isn't, and the ability to get the public's attention, even if you do your job in the next 13 days, is immense, if not impossible.
We're trying like crazy to do it. We had some candidate profiles run just before this happened.
Yes.
We've got other things lined up. We're trying to figure out how we shoehorn them into the paper and into the public consciousness. It's not easy. It's not easy. Guys, I apologize.
It's fine. Brian, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for sharing the news with us again on the lead of this. Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe, the lead of Boston.com, official: possible suspect seen in an image at second bomb site. And Brian's perception is that when there is a press availability later this afternoon, he said at 4, whatever time it is this afternoon, that it's very possible that we may see the image. And he says it's pretty defined, well-defined.
Brian McGroy is with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon at 1 o'clock. We just got an email, Jim, from a gentleman who said the Milwaukee Brewers played the Cheers theme at their park last night. He said, choked me up more than Sweet Caroline. Watch for a lot of emotion at the Bruins game tonight. It's a great
email.
Well,
also particularly since the 8-year-old boy
exactly.
was a huge Bruins fan.
Yeah. Okay, in the aftermath of the Sandy Hook shootings, everyone was behind gun reform. Today, 4 months later, could we have an easier time passing a bill on terrorism? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH.
For kids in public school, it's hard to get away from standardized tests for reading and math, and at some schools, a test for creativity.
Initially, I thought, as many people do, well, creativity is not something you can measure. It's this sort of wonderful gift, and let's not question it too carefully.
Testing for creativity, today on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Today at 4, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Gardner Mattress, specializing in handmade, lace-tufted, and custom-made mattresses. Handcrafted wood bed frames on display also, celebrating 80 years, located in Salem, Woburn, and Newton. GardnerMattress.com. And Boston Ballet's Next Generation, celebrating Boston's youth in the arts. You can enjoy a collaboration of students from Boston Ballet School and New England Conservatory's Youth Philharmonic Orchestra. May 8th, BostonBallet.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today, the Senate takes its first votes on the content of gun control bills. Conventional wisdom is that even the bipartisan compromise on background checks is hanging by a thread. Here to describe what impact the four-month lag since Newtown may have on what the Senate does or doesn't do today is Dan Ariely's professor of behavioral economics at Duke, the James B. Duke professor. His latest book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Dan, the conventional wisdom, and polls show it too, that the emotions since Sandy Hook, people are not as pro-gun control as they were. How does your research say this will affect what happens with the final gun legislation?
Well, so with any kind of legislation, there are basically two forces. There's the force from the people and the force from the legislators. And in this kind of psychology, both of them are going in the same way. Once so much time has passed, people don't feel as passionate about it, and they don't pay attention to it as much. So these days, there's no question that if we had some legislation on terrorism, it would probably pass with flying colors and very, very quickly. But a legislation about a tragedy that happened a while ago, I don't know if we want to call 4 months a while ago, is just not grappling us with emotion in the same way. What's interesting about emotions is that they have a dramatic effect on our behavior, but this effect is really short-term, and it doesn't last even as long as we think it does. So it goes all the way from when we're in love, we think we'll be in love forever. When we're angry, we think we'll be angry forever. And those emotions are temporary and they go away, and when they go away, they don't influence our decision making.
But you know, there is some wisdom also today, Dan Ariely, that the intervention of what happened on Monday in Boston has even hurt the effort. So in addition to emotions beginning to lag over a period of time, when emotion about another major event fills the hole, does that make it even more distant and even more difficult to respond to?
Yeah, because now our attention is focused on something completely different. Our emotions are occupied with something else. You know, when you have a particular pain, for example, it's a good idea to rub a different part of your body. It kind of distract from that particular part of your body into something else.
Really?
The same thing is about emotions. Yes, absolutely.
Actually, I didn't know pain, that.
So now you've learned something.
I've learned something. That's great. A great piece of advice. But go ahead, Dan. I'm sorry.
It's very hard for us to have multiple emotions about multiple things at the same time. If we're hungry, we're hungry. If we're in love, we're in love. It's very hard to have these multiple emotions at multiple targets at the same time. So now that our attention is so consumed by the tragedy in Boston, it is very hard for us to focus with the same intensity on a different tragedy. It's very hard to feel. And the results from a lot of research has basically shown something called the identifiable victim effect. And the idea of the identifiable victim effect is that large, distant tragedies don't really compel us into actions. But when something is salient and individual, our emotions kind of flare up, and then they compel us into actions. That's why lots of charities, when they raise money, they don't tell you there's a million kids in Africa who needs your money. There's one kid, and this is their face, and they need your money. So what causes us to care and therefore to act is usually an individual case, one picture, one story, and therefore we act. So if we think about this question of legislation, this is going to be a really sad suggestion and kind of cruel. But I think if somebody wants to get a legislation like this passed, what they need to do is just put it in the drawer and wait for another tragedy to happen. And then whip it out a day later after another shooting. Because right now the emotions are just not high enough, and the odds that this would pass, I think, is much lower.
But one of the things that I think may counter what you're saying is that even though the public's emotions do change quickly, and Newtown was, I mean, not that long ago, but in terms of holding on to that emotion a long time ago, but these parents have been relentless, the Newtown parents. They have been down talking to individual senators, people that are opposed to gun legislation. And I think that's because they are such effective spokesmen. So the experience is immediate for those legislators. Does that matter?
Yeah. And if you think about something like the American Cancer Society, right? How do they raise money? They basically take victims and survivors of cancer, and they get them to go and approach their families and say, you know, help us in our fight. And by doing that, it makes it personal to many, many more people. So the parents are doing a great effort, and they're having an impact. But it is tough to fight the winding down emotions. It's hard to fight the time that is passing. It's hard to fight the fact that there's all kinds of other tragedies are happening all the time, and our attention is just drifting away, and our emotions are drifting away. So it's not to say that they're not doing a great job, but the force they're working against is incredibly powerful.
Hey, Dan,
it's hard to...
Dan Ariely, last question from me, though. Is your research extend to when I agree with the notion that one is much more likely to make a decision for better or worse when you're in the throes of emotion. Have you done research on the quality of that decision making, whether it's a legislator in Washington or whether it's a human being, not that they're not all human beings, reacting, as you say, to love and that sort of thing? How good is our emotion-based decision making?
Well, our emotions-based decision-making are both good and bad. You know, these are decisions that get us to be compelled to act and help people. When you see somebody in trouble, at that moment, you're compelled to help them out. So a lot of human heroism in the good side of us comes because we follow our emotions and we don't do the calculations of is this good or is this bad. At the same time, lots of bad decisions are happening. So we can't just say, is emotion good or bad? I do want to say one other thing. We have done some research to ask the question of how can you prolong the effect of emotions? If emotions are just temporary, can you do something to make their effect on decision-making last longer? And one of the things we found is that if people are in the throne of emotion, are making one decision, that decision could then be the anchor for later decisions. So, for example, if a day after an attack, you get people to make a straw vote, or you get people to commit or to sign a petition, they've done that under the influence of the emotion. But when they look at it 4 months later, they say, I remember signing this petition. I remember taking this act. And therefore, the emotion can create a small action and can later create a large action. And that would have been another way to approach this issue.
Hey, Dan Ariely, I have great news for you. I just rubbed my knee. My headache went away.
Oh, wonderful.
Dan, thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
Dan is a professor at professor at Duke University, and his latest book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves.
You know, we're going to try to walk and chew gum at the same time here, which neither of us are particularly good at the same time that we have critical votes on gun control today, one of the major initiatives before the United States Congress, and we'll get back to that in a second. We talked to Brian McGorry a minute ago about this breaking news. The Herald is now mentioning that it is the source from CNN. Let me read you from CNN's website. Investigators believe they have identified a suspect in the Boston Marathon bombings. A source who has been briefed on the investigation told CNN's John King exclusively. John, as you know, is with us every Tuesday at noon. The breakthrough came from analysis of video from a department store near the site of the second explosion. Video from a Boston television station, doesn't say which one, also contributed to the progress, said the source, who declined to be more specific but called it a significant development. Obviously, we're going to stay on top of this till 2 o'clock. Our colleagues will stay on top of it all day. And again, this presser this afternoon, this press event this afternoon, at, we believe at 4 o'clock, will hopefully fill in some of the blanks. We're going to stay on top of that. But we also both believe that this these votes this afternoon on gun control are pretty important to all of you and all of us. So we're going to talk to Todd Zwillick now. He's on the line from D.C. He's the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Todd, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, guys. Good to be with you.
Hi, Todd. So as Jim just said, today at about 4 o'clock, the Senate is going to be taking up amendments to gun legislation. And as of yesterday, it was not looking very good, even for expanded background checks. So where are we now, Todd?
Well, that's about where we are. We're looking at this afternoon, you're right, sort of a mini what's often called a vote-a-rama around here, big group of votes. We're looking at nine of them back to back to back. The Manchin-Toomey background check compromise, which we've been talking an awful lot about on your show and on The Takeaway and everywhere else, will be part of the mix. And it looks now like it's in the neighborhood of five votes shy of the 60 votes it will need. There's no way to know if that five will stick in the end. But five is a pretty big number when you're 4 hours or so away from a vote. One of the dispositive moments came earlier, sort of late this morning, when Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who was an undecided and thought to potentially go either way on the issue, announced that she would be a no vote on Manchin-Toomey. And then the math starts to look like it's quite unlikely at that point.
Well, and also a former attorney general, for those who don't know, Kelly Ayotte, and a moderate Republican as compared to some of the other undecided. So we're essentially it seems to me, as someone who's not where you are, that if an expansion of background checks, which has the support of two guys, it's led by two guys who have A ratings, or at least used to have A ratings from the NRA, Senator Toomey from my home state of Pennsylvania, Senator Manchin from West Virginia, if that doesn't have the votes, it's ridiculous to think that anything like an assault weapons ban or a ban on high-capacity magazines will get anywhere. Is that a fair statement, Todd?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's an absolutely fair statement. And as I'm sure you remember, the idea of renewing the assault weapons ban that expired in 2004 or instituting a limit on the capacity of clips for semi-automatic weapons was faltered before it ever started. I mean, the assault weapons ban doesn't even appear to have 40 votes, which, you know, if it did have 40 votes, Harry Reid could have included it in the base mm-hmm. bill and forced the opponents to get 60 to take it out. And at the time, he said, it doesn't even have 40, so if I put it in the bill, they're going to strip it out, and they can do it. So we're not going to let it bog down this bill and pile more opposition on top of it. We took it out of the bill, make Senator Feinstein and her allies try to get 60 to put it in. Of course, they don't have it, but it doesn't lard down the bill with other controversial measures. That was supposed to be part of the rationale for the idea of expanded background checks, the bipartisan idea, ultimately, to get onto the bill. And that, at this point, looks unlikely as well.
So, Todd Zwillich, is it an overstatement to say that while people in New England and much of America are focused, and now even more focused since there may be a suspect identified, on what happened in Boston at 2:50 on Monday, is it possible by the time we go to sleep tonight, we're going to have a pretty good sense of whether gun control legislation has gone anywhere in the Congress?
Well, you'll have more of a sense, but you won't have an exclusive sense. And we have to kind of warn about that. The Senate, this is a cliche, is a funny place. Here's the way this is set up. There are 9 votes today. Now, in some ways, this is a make or break for the idea of expanded background checks. It certainly is for things like assault weapons ban, and capacity clips. Incidentally, there are amendments that expand gun rights. We should probably talk about those too. But here's the way it's going to work. They're going to do 9 votes. Once all the dust settles on these 9 votes and Reid and everyone else makes an assessment on what's passed and what's failed, and by the way, they're doing the same over in the House as they watch this thing develop, then they get together. There is room in the procedure here to do more amendments. It's not necessarily closed down after this. Okay, what passed? We got this one thing. There are other ideas waiting in the wings about, you know, for instance, allowing or encouraging states who adjudicate people to be legally mentally incompetent or danger to themselves or others or not guilty by reason of insanity. Right now, it can be really hard for the federal background check system to know who those people are.
Go ahead, Todd.
That's
finish.
Okay. Well, just a lot of people, including Republicans, want to beef that up. That's not in the mix quite yet. It probably will be later. There are other moving parts of this. But the overall picture of what you're asking about is once something does get out of the Senate, remember, there is a base bill at work here that is being amended. If that gets out of the Senate, the House, much more conservative than the Senate, run by the Republican conference, which has very little interest in gun control. However, there is some public pressure for this. There is Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly running around. There is the President of the United States on the bully pulpit. There are the families from Newtown. All of these things are important, and the House Republicans are waiting to see. They haven't walked out on a limb saying we will pass, we won't pass. They're waiting to see what can the Senate get. If the Senate passes something with like one Republican on it, then Boehner and Cantor and the House Republicans behind them don't feel a whole lot of pressure to go against the NRA and against the wishes of a lot of people in the red districts and do something. If there's another compromise reached and a lot of Republicans get on board, all of a sudden it's 12 or 15, you bet it's a much different calculation. So they're waiting back to see what ultimately happens here.
But one environmental thing you didn't mention, we were just talking with a professor from Duke about it, is the further away one gets from the thing that inspired so many people to believe there was a chance, December 14th looks further behind in the rearview mirror. You know, Todd, before we let you go, I want to mention one more thing. You touched on this, which to me is the most surreal aspect of this whole debate, regardless of what side one is on. My understanding is this amendment that would force states to respect other states' concealed carry of weapons laws is what you, I assume that's what you're talking about, is that we may end up with an expansion of gun owners' rights rather than an expansion of gun control in the Senate debate this afternoon. Is that what you're talking about, that particular piece?
It is known to wonks around here as reciprocity.
Uh-huh.
So one state with concealed carry has to respect concealed carry in another state. There is another amendment that would loosen interstate transport of firearms. There are a couple of gun expansion amendments already in the mix. They may well pass. There is a Republican background check alternative, which does not expand existing background checks, but kind of cracks down on enforcement and has some other measures. This is a Lindsey Graham, Grassley, Ted Cruz of Texas proposal, which does have expanded interstate carry provisions in it. So, and that we don't know if that's going to get its 60. You know, sometimes these things work their way out on the floor. And another small part of the dynamic of having 9 votes back to back to back, senators are on the floor for a good long time. They are negotiating. When you see them on C-SPAN kind of chatting, sometimes they're talking about, hey, did you see the basketball game this weekend? In a case like this, there's an awful lot of negotiating going on and trying to yank people over to your side as Amendment 1 goes down, Amendment 3 passes, Amendment 2 is on the bubble. That's what's going to be going on likely this afternoon. So we could wind up with some expanded gun rights. It's unlikely, I think, that we will have exclusively expanded gun rights, because remember, these are amendments going on to a base bill that does have some gun control measures already embedded. Can that thing pass? We can't know yet.
You know, this is just driving me insane. I've got to say, I know I'm in progressive Massachusetts and we're a blue state and we have very strict gun control laws. But you just say to yourself, if you want to buy essentially a killing machine, which is what a lot of these weapons are, and we can't say you need to have a background check beforehand to make sure that you're not a terrorist or you're not some totally irresponsible person, it just is crazy.
Wait a second. Excuse me, Margaret. Forget progressive Massachusetts. 90% of Americans support background checks that are broader than the Manchin-Toomey compromise.
And so, we don't want to hold Todd up on this whole thing.
But we do.
But part of the reason I think we can't get anywhere on this is because you're so afraid of not being reelected, which is why you were so wrong about these term limits, Jim Brady.
Hey, Todd, one last thing for me. Todd Zwillick from The Takeaway. There have been a number of columns written, more than a number, it's a growing number since Monday afternoon, which suggests that what happened about 2 miles away from where Marjorie and I are sitting on Monday is going to have some negative effect on the effort of gun control activists in the Congress, specifically in the Senate. Are you buying any of that?
I don't think there's really any way to know, especially at this moment when, okay, maybe they have a suspect, as you read out from CNN there. You don't know who that person is. You don't know what their motivation was. You know, in the political environment and the media environment, that's going to make an enormous amount of difference. Look, if the person is a foreign national who snuck into the country, is that going to have an effect on the immigration debate? Probably. If the person is Al-Qaeda sympathizer or operative, will that have an effect on the national security debate? Of course it will. If that person is a gun rights activist or some kind of right-wing sympathizer, will that have an effect on the Second Amendment debate? Yeah, probably. But without having any idea about what the profile of this person is, none of those things I mentioned or some weird combination of all three, who knows how senators will react or how they feel like the media pressure and constituent pressure will bear down upon them to do either something or nothing.
Todd Zwillick, thank you as always for being with us. I much appreciate it.
Pleasure. Anytime, guys.
Todd Zwillick is the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. We're going to open the lines to you guys at 877-301-8970. To your reaction, we just had the breaking news about being a suspect being identified in a picture. We haven't seen the picture yet, unfortunately, but the law enforcement community has, and it is of a person, a man, that's all we know about him at this point, who is seen dropping a bag near the site of the second blast, apparently taken from some video footage inside a department store,
Lord and Taylor. Yeah.
And also there was apparently some footage from a local television station. We don't know which one. John King broke that story for CNN. John King, as Jim says, with us every Tuesday. Your reaction to that? Your reaction to just the whole outpouring of support we've seen in the city of Boston after this terrible tragedy from the EMTs, firefighters, cops, our heroes, first responders, the medical community, Mass General, Brigham and Women's, Beth Israel, etc., and from just regular people that were at the side of the race. 877-301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970. All that up next. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH.
Hugh Masekela is probably one of Africa's most recognized musicians. He's performed all over the world with everybody from Bob Marley to The Byrds. He's in his 70s now, but don't expect him to slow down. Hugh Masekela joins us for a Wisdom Watch conversation. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Bunker Hill Community College, where Fairuzeh Dumas, author of Funny in Farsi, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America, will speak on April 18th at 1 p.m. RSVP at bhcc.mass.edu/onebook. And Elsa Dorfman, Cambridge portrait photographer, still clicking with the jumbo format Polaroid 20x24 analog camera and original Polaroid film. Online at elsadorfman.com. That's elsadorfman.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Sort of an odd anomaly, if that's not repetitive. While CNN has said they have the story of a photograph that authorities have of a suspect they believe in the second bombing, CNN says that the original story was posted at 1:11. We spoke to Brian McGrory before. Their story was posted at 1:07. So sadly, we don't know who got this story first. What we do know is, even though we've told you that the press conference is at 3 today or at 4, in fact, it is at 5 o'clock today,
where
authorities will
Jim.
Hopefully disclose both the photo and information they have, and we will carry that live, obviously, on Boston Public Radio. We're going to spend the rest of today taking your phone calls about this pretty stunning development only 2 days in. Our number is 877-301-8970.
I just have a question for you, Jim, before we begin.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't like all these cameras everywhere. Came in handy this time.
Well, it did, Marjorie. That's a very fine point, and thank you for putting me on the spot. Where are we going first?
Where are we going first?
Let's go to James on the Cape. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, James.
Well, welcome, and thank you for taking my call. It's the first one I've gotten to speak to in your new
We're glad to have you. Thanks, James.
Here.
What's up?
Well, a lot of things. You know, I'm as disgusted as everybody by what happened, and I wanted to talk a little bit about gun control. The idea of expanding background checks is nice, but there are so many people that fail background checks now and don't get prosecuted for attempting to purchase a weapon. I really fail to see what the point of expanding background checks would be. Are we going to expand them so we're not prosecuting more people who attempt to...
James, forget prosecution for a second. I think I can answer the question. Since these background checks have first been done, it may be off by a little, roughly 1.8 million people over a decade failed them. That's number one. Number two, even if they're not prosecuted, I don't know who's prosecuted and who's not, at least for the time being, that person who failed the background check, either for criminal records reasons or for mental illness reasons, doesn't have a weapon, at least doesn't have a weapon legally.
Let me finish if I can.
There are two more elements to this, James. Third, as you know, a huge percentage, those numbers come without a huge percentage of gun transactions being covered by background checks. That's third. And fourth, 90% of the American people have heard the arguments of both sides, and they want the people who represent them to do it. So it seems to me those are four pretty good reasons, James.
I really dispute the 90% number, but then again,
Excuse me, just for a second, James, because we're just getting some breaking news. The Associated Press is reporting that an arrest is imminent in the Boston Marathon bombing, and a suspect is going to be brought to court. This is really developing very, very quickly.
James, we've got to go only because obviously this is a hot story. James, thank you so much for the call. And by the way, those 90% numbers that James said he doubts, and I respect his opinion, are actually polling from responsible organizations.
They come from poll after poll after poll after poll.
By the way, this is staggering. I mean, you know, every expert, and maybe they said this so that people were more patient, every single law enforcement expert, from the people on the stage to commentators from beyond the stage we've seen at the four press conferences, says this is going to be a long slog. This is not going to be something where we're going to find somebody almost overnight. But it appears that
Did not the story say they got a clear picture of this individual?
That's what Brian told us.
I mean, don't
Brian
you
McGurry
find
us,
that
yeah.
shocking? I mean, if you were going to be dropping off a bomb somewhere, wouldn't you have a sweatshirt on or a baseball cap on and sunglasses on?
Well, I'd say yes, but I would argue if you're crazy and sadistic enough to want to kill other innocent people in large numbers, then maybe you're crazy and stupid enough to do things that get you discovered.
Okay, let's go to, where are we going?
Richard and Haverhill, you're next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Richard. Richard. We're not going to Richard. 87.
Hi, Richard.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
At the beginning, I thought this might be something to do with our Middle East policies. Maybe it was somebody from, you know, an Arab country. But it looks like it's leaning more to domestic, somebody domestically. But, you know, Osama bin Laden, getting back to 9/11, he justified 9/11 because we had a base in Saudi Arabia, and most of the hijackers were Saudi Arabians. So
yes.
I just hope, you know, that, you know, our drone, whether you agree with our drone foreign policy or not, that we certainly are killing terrorists, but we also there's a lot of collateral damage, guys. And, you know, there's just a lot of people in the world, you know, mad at us about that and want to get back at us. You know?
Well, beyond the anger, whether people around the world were angry or not, there are a lot of people. And this is one of the few areas where conservatives like Rand Paul are joined by liberal Democrats in saying the president's policy, this drones policy, which is killing thousands of innocent civilians, or is something that, beyond the constitutional implications, is something that many of us think shouldn't be done in our name. Richard, thank you so much for the call. I'm stunned by this, by the way. I am stunned. We, as the AP is reporting, as Marjorie said, a suspect will be brought to court, possibly brought to court before this press availability this afternoon at 5 o'clock. This thing is changing as we speak.
Our number is 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. You know, I'm dying to know how this happened, how you get this image of this individual dropping a package, and then
you think
within,
you're alone
within
in that?
Minutes, we have an arrest imminent. We presume that meant that they had this person on their radar.
Or that they had the image. I mean, even though they've been asking, please send us more video, please send us more photographs, if in fact this is from Lord and Taylor, one must assume it was turned over immediately after the fact. Maybe they've been studying this thing. That's what we'll learn in the next couple of hours. 877-301-8970. This is like wildly exciting, I should say.
You know something, though? On the other hand, I mean, I think we have a great human nature. There's a great urge to apprehend someone and bring them to justice. On the other hand, it's not going to change anything.
I do think it. If your point is, does it fix anything? Well, I don't know how much it fixes. There's still three dead people. There's still
exactly.
170 people who have suffered
exactly.
injuries, many grievous. But that they're not mutually exclusive notions. Those have happened. They can't be undone. We'll do the best for those people. You mentioned when we were talking to Dr. Zinner from Brigham before the chief surgeon that prosthetics have come a long way. Many of those lives are going to go on. And I would bet, I don't want to speak for anybody who suffered. My guess is every one of those 180-some families
are
going to be
very pleased. You want them apprehended. You absolutely do.
That,
you absolutely do. But it's just, you know, the horrible damage has been done, and the change in our attitude about this race has come. And it would be great if we get this person this afternoon. It's great if he's guilty, if I presume it's a he. And that is interesting.
Or they or whatever.
Always a he.
Well, there's some suicide bombers have been women. But you're right. The vast majority have been men. But we're not that far away from finding out. And by the way, when we leave here, obviously you should stay with Boston Public Radio all day long. We'll bring you the press conference live at 5 o'clock. And obviously any updates as the day goes ahead.
Dan from Lynn, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. What's up?
Hi, folks. Beautiful afternoon. Good to have an opportunity to share my opinion.
Good.
Sure.
You know, from the beginning, from jump, people were talking about foreigners and terrorists. I mean, 9/11, I call them all criminals, and the people who the people or the person, I think there was more than one. I think they were criminals, and they are criminals. I also think that these type of people, they know they're very interested in U.S. history, like McVeigh was. Patriots Day, April 19th, what the Founding Fathers were all about. I think they're very intelligent. As far as they have a suspect, I'm very skeptical of this suspect, the breaking news. And I don't think these people are really interested in Red Sox games and Bruins games and being a Bostonian. And I think they're more interested in what their government is not doing for them, what politicians are not doing for them, living like royalty, and they're being isolated and pushed to the edges of society.
Dan, you're really wildly speculating here. We have no idea. I mean, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. We have no idea. There are people that, despite what our earlier guest said about suspecting someone is doing something next door, many times it's amazing to me in situations like this or in a murder and some other atrocity, the neighbors will tell you, gee, so-and-so was a great guy until he blew up the house, or so-and-so brought in the groceries for the old lady that lived across the street until he massacred his father. So you never know, Dan.
But hey, Dan, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. By the way, CNN and Globe are reporting that arrest actually has been made in the bombing, that an arrest has been made. Let's try to squeeze another call or two in before we are done. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's go to John from Fairhaven. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Great.
Good.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a case of, with all these cameras and all these phones taking pictures and everything, if somebody in the crowd actually saw someone who they remembered and recognized, who they actually knew, and they told somebody about it.
Well, the initial reports, that may be the case, and we'll find out more as the day goes along, John, but the initial reports suggest that it's video from Lorden Taylor, and this is according to CNN, Taylor's video camera and an unnamed television station in town that led to this breakthrough.
Great. It's fantastic.
Well,
right,
this
Thank you.
And what great police work by the FBI, by the ATF, by the Boston Police, by the State Police, law enforcement. I mean, this makes you really proud of the law enforcement effort here, obviously.
Well, also, I mean, you put me on the spot a little while ago, and I wasn't happy to be put on the spot, but it was legitimate. We talked to Michael Goldfarb yesterday from Global Post in London.
Uh-huh.
About hundreds, the typical person in London is captured on a photograph or video 300 to 400 times a day or more. I am against these public cameras in these places. It's going to be pretty hard to make the argument by me and others tomorrow if what broke this case
was a video camera. Public cameras.
Why is that, Marjorie?
Because you're a slitherer. You're slithering around in those dark corners, and you don't want to be found.
You know, I know you will mock me for this too.
Uh-huh.
I have not done much crime reporting in my time. Now, you've covered a lot of crimes, small and large. It is the speed with which this has been pulled
it's
together.
It's fantastic.
Assuming there is an arrest, and again, that's what's being reported, and that we are going to have some identification of this later this afternoon, it is staggering how fast this has moved.
The Huffington Post is reporting, and I am just reporting what an emailer is reporting. The Huffington Post is reporting that the photo of the tan backpack was from WHDH, Channel 7. We'll find that out. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that is what has been reported via an emailer from the Huffington Post.
And all this is going to happen in the next couple of hours. Obviously, we're going to be updating here on Boston Public Radio, 89.7. All developments throughout the afternoon, you should stay here. In addition to that, one of the developments we know, in addition to whatever court proceeding, I don't know if there'll be an arraignment today, there will be a press conference that is scheduled as we speak at 5 o'clock this afternoon, at which time the authorities, I assume led by the FBI and the governor, will tell us what they know. But in the last 50 minutes, things have changed pretty dramatically. Obviously, I mean, you know you're listening to Boston Public Radio, WGBH 89.7. Tomorrow from noon to 2, we're going to be talking about all the things we learned in the next several hours. So stay tuned to 89.7 Boston Public Radio. You can obviously follow us and get news at wgbh.org/BPR. This almost takes my breath away. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Stick around to this station all day long, and we will be back on these mics promptly at noon tomorrow.